start, I'd like to say good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's teleclass, Implementing the National Decontamination Programme in the UK. My name's Debbie King, and I have the pleasure, along with Lauren Chu and Maria Benalik, of organising the UK-based teleclass series with the able assistance of Paul Webber. So thank you for joining us. And I'd like to take this opportunity to thank our sponsor today, Zeb UK Limited, for helping us to make this teleclass possible. Hopefully, we will have some time for questions at the end of today's session. If not, if you would like to email me at debbie@webbertraining.com, we'll pass your questions on to Peter Hooper and hopefully do our best to answer them and get back to you as soon as we can. So with that, I'd like to welcome Peter Hooper. Peter's a chartered mechanical engineer who joined the NHS in Birmingham in 1969 as a building service design engineer. During his 25-year service, he's worked in Bristol, Harrogate and Oxford and specialised in steam sterilisation and decontamination. He was appointed regional steriliser engineer at Oxford in 1984 and became the first registered authorised person in 1994. Setting up his own decontamination and authorised person consultancy in 1995, he's travelled widely in Europe, the US, Middle East, Far East and Australia, speaking on and training on his topic. He's been the treasurer of the Central Sterilising Club and is co-editor of Central Service, a European journal with a worldwide readership. He has advised the Department of Health and been involved in the auditing for the decontamination programme. Having written a number of articles and been heavily involved in the production of many UK guidance documents, including health building notes and health technical memoranda, we're honoured to have Peter Hooper join us today for the teleclass Implementing the National Decontamination Programme in the UK. So over to you, Peter.
Thank you very much, Debbie, for that kind introduction. Good afternoon, everybody, wherever you are. I'm speaking to you from Banbury in the middle of the UK, where the weather is very bright and sunny, so I hope it's the same with you. You have hopefully a copy of my notes where the slides are numbered, and I will be referring to slide numbers as we go through. Starting at the title page, some of you may be slightly amused by my title, which is an authorised person bracket sterilisers. Just to define that terminology, it was first produced in HDM 2010, that's Department of Health documentation, in 1994, and the role of an authorised person is defined as somebody who gives advice, independent and impartial advice, to people who use decontamination equipment. And I also audit the way in which people use their decontamination equipment and how their decontamination systems work. So the role is an advisory role, internal advisory only, has no executive authority by definition, and the role of an authorised person is not a mandatory requirement. So NHS trusts and people using sterilisers have the choice of whether to use somebody like an authorised person to give them independent advice. In terms of the title of the session this afternoon, Implementing the National Decontamination Programme in the UK, my aim really is to talk about the decontamination programme in full, but in order to do that, what I need to do is really to talk about its origins, how the programme came about, why it came about, importantly. Essentially, this will have an initial reference to acute trusts, but as we develop into the phase two of the decontamination program, there's an increasing involvement for PCTs and requirements for PCTs. So effectively, what I'll be talking about this afternoon has an involvement for acute trusts and PCTs and eventually anybody who's using decontamination equipment to make reusable devices safe. Okay. Another point I just need to make is that most of the discussion will be about the English situation. Those of you will know that we have basically four different NHSs in UK. That's in England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. And they each do slightly different things as they're entitled to. But I will, at the end of the session, just try and bring you up to date with the scenario in Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland by making some comparisons with the English situation. And my final note before I start is really that this is a personal interpretation of how the National Decontamination Programme has been implemented. Hopefully most of it will be, or some of it will be familiar to some of you, and I guess some of you will already have been involved in trying to implement the program from whatever area you're working in. Okay, if we start the teleclass by moving on to slide number 2, first of all, we need a definition of what I'm going to be talking about. Now, I'm defining the National Decontamination Program as essentially a two-stage process designed to raise the standard of decontamination of reusable medical devices within the UK. A fairly simple statement, but some important implications from that sentence. It's a two-stage process, and we will see there are vast differences between stage 1 and stage 2 of this implementation. We need to understand the difference between reusable devices and single-use medical devices. There's been a lot of discussion internationally and within Europe about the reuse of single-use medical devices, but here in the UK, the requirements are very, very simple and straightforward. Single-use devices are plainly single-use and should not be reprocessed or reused. So what we are talking about here is a program for the decontamination of reusable medical devices. As I say, the process is in two stages. Slide 3 introduces stage 1 of the decontamination progress, and this actually started around about 1999 and lasted until well into 2001. Now, I've quoted you from the then UK Minister of Health, Frank Dobson, at the time, about the purpose of stage 1 of the National Decontamination Program. It was an investment to underpin a major overhaul to provide the NHS with the most up-to-date decontamination services. Now, the effect of this overhaul has been so great that in the last 6 years or so, we have made tremendous strides in decontamination within the NHS. So much so that it's very difficult to think back to what the situation was prior to that in 1999 and preceding years. But we will need to assess what the situation was in 99 and preceding years before we progress much further. To illustrate how much we have progressed, for example, within these 6 years, if an NHS trust wishes to install thermal washer disinfectors within a sterile services department, it's unthinkable these days to install washer disinfectors without a requisite water purification or RO unit. Before 2000, this was absolutely unheard of. So we have made amazing strides in decontamination, and it's sometimes difficult to remember exactly what we used to do before. At the bottom of slide 3, you will see some quantification that the Department of Health put on this major overhaul to update decontamination services, and it was of the order of £200 million being made available to fund a variety of purposes. So it was clearly at that time a major investment by the Department of Health. Moving on to stage 4, slide 4, to introduce stage 2 of the process, which began around about 2003 and is ongoing as we speak, you will first of all notice that there was a gap between 2001 and 2003 while stage 2 was being prepared, and I'll talk about what that included in a couple of slides. But just to introduce stage 2, again, reading from the documentation that accompanied the introduction of this stage, you'll notice that this was all about the design and delivery of a long-term sustainable solution beyond the £200 million allocated in Stage 1. So what we have here is an indication that the Stage 1 funding was insufficient to meet what was then considered to be the requirements for a sustainable and improved standard. And the second quote on slide 4 just reiterates that the stage 1 funds would not be sufficient to bring all sterile service sites to a sustainable and improved standard. That suggests that around about 2003, therefore, that there was an understanding that this was going to be a very expensive process within the NHS. And the numbers I've quoted, remember, are for England and not for the UK as a whole. This obviously raises the question on slide 5 about why this need to raise the standard was necessary at all. The question goes, what was wrong with sterile services in 2000 and before that, and what happens about decontamination outside sterile services, which were really the major interest of stages 1 and 2? And as I said, we need to go back to 1999 and beyond to try and remember what the situation was like. I can best give you an analysis of this by an NHS trust that was assessed during stage one of the process, and it was not untypical. So these were figures that were quite commonly found within the UK, and particularly in England NHS. A trust would have, for example, on a two-site trust, it could have a sterile services in each of the two sites, and in excess of 100 sites of local decontamination, each with their own small transportable sterilizer within the confines of those two sites in an acute trust. So effectively, we had 102 sites where decontamination was being performed, and in at least 100 of those sites, there were major shortcomings and non-compliances within the decontamination. If we looked at the situation in primary care and also in the private sector, in places such as dentists, acupuncturists, and tattooists, for example, there was a collection of procedures which one would have described as all and sundry, really. And there was a grave need understood here to have a single approach to decontamination, which provided, in a validated way, instrumentation that was safe for reuse on patients. Now, that situation that existed in 1999 had existed for a long period before that. So there obviously was a need and an impetus to make this change, which was going to lead to the spending of vast sums of money to solve what was then identified a problem. Now, I'm sure you're all aware, and forgive me for repeating this, but on slide six, there's just a brief history of why the impetus and why this occurred and why the situation changed around about 1999 to 2000. And you see the numbered points on slide six. We're really talking about the situation that started with the outbreak of BSE in the mid to late 1980s. And those of you who were involved in this process then would remember there was a larger discussion, because there was a lot of publicity about BSE, about whether this was having any effect on us as human beings and whether the consumption of beef that may or may not have been BSE contaminated had any health effects on us at all. And that unknown situation went on for a long time until, I think it was Stephen Dorrell, the then health minister, made a statement in the House of Commons identifying that a new variation of classical Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, CJD, had been identified in a new group of patients showing slightly different symptoms but showing vastly different age susceptibilities for this variation of CJD. So effectively, from that date onwards, we were talking about a variant CJD, and then determining what was, first of all, the cause of variant CJD. The assumption was that consumption of BSE-contaminated beef was the cause of that problem, and then to determine whether it had any effect on us as individual human beings for whatever reason. I think the jury was out on that question for some time until a patient died in a hospital of variant CJD, a hospital in which he had not long before, whilst he was not showing any symptoms of variant CJD, had been in for surgical procedure. And his tissue sample was still on file, and it was inspected after his death, and the tissue sample showed what we were then able to define as the causative agent of variant CJD, the prion protein. Now, that situation was both good news and bad news in a way, because the good news was that it was felt there may be a marker or an indicator for general population to determine the degree of incidence of variant CJD. So a lot of such similar samples were investigated up and down the country, and somewhat inconclusive results were obtained. But the bad news in that was that it was then appreciated that the instruments used for the surgical procedure on this patient would have gone through conventional universal precautions for decontamination at the time, and it was already known that, although we didn't know very much about variant CJD at the time, we did know that standard steam sterilization was incapable of destroying, that's the word we would have used at that time, of destroying the causative agent of classical CJD. This is a bit of an enigma, really, that whilst we knew that conventional steam sterilization didn't destroy classical CJD and was therefore a possible risk for patients for some time previous to that, the incidence of classical CJD had not altered and was virtually invariably one in a million cases per annum. And because that number remained static, we felt that this lack of ability to destroy prion protein was not introducing a risk to patients. The introduction or the discovery of the variant CJD, however, led to this possibility of a risk for a different variation of something that we knew very little about to begin with. The government, I think, was put in a very difficult position and had to assess what it was going to do to minimize, if not eliminate, a possibility, however small, of contamination via the reuse of surgical instruments, which may inadvertently or unknowingly have been used on a patient incubating variant CJD. So there was a need to find a solution to this problem, and at the same time, then to determine whether the current decontamination practices and procedures in use were actually fulfilling the requirements of making instruments safe for reuse on patients. Turning on to slide 7, we then need to look at what the solution was actually suggested by the government for this particular problem. Now, I said we knew a little bit about classical CJD, and if we go back a few decades, some research work suggested that either a combination of 6 sterilization cycles at 134 degrees C for 3 minutes, or possibly a single cycle of 18 minutes, in other words, a combination of 6 cycles all in one go, was capable of destroying the causative agent of classical sporadic CJD. One of the first research projects undertaken following the government difficulty with this tended to place some doubt on that original research. And it was soon felt that we were not able to rely upon a combination of 6 sterilization cycles or a single cycle with an 18-minute period to make items safe. Some of you may remember the introduction of the so-called prion cycle to steam sterilizers round about the year 2000-2001 that acted in this way. But the doubt placed on the effectiveness on variant CJD, the modeling process suggested that we could not place full faith in the sterilizer to actually remove this as a problem. So there was a search for a different solution to the CJD problem, and item 3 on slide 7, although appearing very impractical, and actually in practice very impractical, the use of universal use of single-use devices was suggested as a possible cure for the variant CJD contamination problem. And of course, this is a very elegant and a very good solution, but wholly impractical and completely non-affordable. There was a race for item number 4 to find some new sterilization processes, and if I'm honest with you, the race to find a new sterilization process capable of deactivating prion protein is ongoing as we speak. We do not yet have a sterilization process capable of meeting the requirements of deactivation, although if we were to do this teleclass in 2, 3, maybe 5 years, we could be talking about the solution to the variant CJD problem, if it remains as serious as this, to be solved by a sterilization process, which may well be a combination of thermal and chemical processes. But at the present moment, we do not have a solution as far as the sterilizer is concerned. So, in a sense, the last port of call for the solution was actually the washer disinfector. Now, just to talk a little bit about washer disinfectors in sterile services around about the year 2000, they were a very minor piece of equipment within a sterile services department. It was always understood that a cleaning process was essential for steam sterilization to work, but the washer disinfector was considered to be a prior process before sterilization, and it was the sterilizer which did all the deactivation, destroying, and whatever. It was sterilizers that made instruments safe. The washer disinfector was there for cosmetic purposes, probably. However, the theory was put forward that if we could ensure that washer disinfectors were capable of removing protein, then if they could remove protein, they could remove the prion protein that may or may not be present on contamination on an instrument. So overnight, the profile of the washer disinfector changed completely. From being a Cinderella piece of equipment in sterile services, it now became at least as important as the sterilizer in the complete decontamination process, and on its own became the major ammunition in the fight against variant CJD and CJD contamination in general. The difficulty here, of course, that if one therefore produces a more complex washer disinfector that can be validated to remove protein, it needs to be tested at validation to do that and needs to be periodically tested on a weekly basis to confirm that it's still capable of removing protein. So chemical tests that respond to the presence of protein are now carried out on washer disinfectors to confirm that the ability to remove protein is still working. Unfortunately, for you, but fortunately for me, we probably don't have time to discuss what happens to the protein when it's removed from the washer disinfector and goes down the drain. I will leave that discussion to microbiologists who know more about that situation than myself. But in short, the solution within the UK to the CJD problem is the washer disinfector, or in general, the cleaning process. It removes the protein from the instruments, so when they come out of the cleaning process, there is no residual protein, therefore no special sterilization process is required. Any remaining bacterial spores, as the worst case, will be killed as normal in a conventional sterilization process. So around about 2000, we had the definition of the solution. So there was a need on the Department of Health's part to investigate how well the current stock of decontamination equipment within sterile services and beyond in England was actually functioning. So slide 8, for example, asks the question or raises the requirement that now face the Department of Health. How well is decontamination being performed, and does this meet the new requirements for the washer disinfector? The department basically didn't know the answer to that question, so had to find out very quickly and had to get some investigation process to assess, review the situation and recommend any changes required together with the relevant funding to do that. And you'll see the little note on the bottom of slide 8. This is where the different NHSs in the UK, the four of them, went in slightly different directions. So the next part of the discussion will be particularly about the situation in England. Slide 9 indicates how the process started. It started with a snapshot survey in England that began at the end of 1999 and went on until early 2000. This was a detailed inspection of a small sample of sites performing decontamination. And you can see examples given on slide 9. They range from a very large university teaching hospital to a very small single practitioner dental practice, and a variation of the spectrum in between. About 30 hospitals were assessed, and the similar number of small units were assessed, so that at the end of the day, the current situation taken from those samples made up the 195-page report of the snapshot survey. And very interesting reading it made, too. If you then look at slide 10, I'm being very delicate here, but effectively, the 195-page report from the snapshot survey was seen to be somewhat politically sensitive because it was critical of current procedures. The parallel situation in Scotland produced an equally critical but somewhat shorter report, which was published for public consumption and was and is still available on the Scottish NHS website. The English report, unfortunately, was buried at the time, but following publicity in the general media, the department really had to do something about the English report, and they said that they would use the English report not as a publication document, but as the basis for a new comprehensive inspection of sterile service departments within the UK. Now, that leads us on to phase one of the National Decontamination Programme, which is the Department of Health's response to the content of the snapshot survey, which was suggesting that the procedures were not as good as we thought they were and were not capable of meeting the new requirements of the washer disinfector to be the main ammunition against variant CJD. So slide 11 introduces the concept of the phase one of the National Decontamination Programme. And this was to assess all sterile service departments within England, including any local decontamination within acute trusts on the same sites, to determine prioritization both for funding for new equipment, for new instrumentation so that local decontamination could be removed, and for any associated work to determine compliance or make compliance available. Obviously, for this, a formalized auditing documentation was needed because this was going to assess all units. So basically, the paperwork forms that had been used in the snapshot survey were slightly altered and became what we now call PAT forms, P-A-T for Process Assessment Tool forms. So the PAT forms were used to assess sterile service departments, a standard question and answer session, standard reporting system, and the standard ability to grade sterile service departments in response to the questions of either yes or no. And the report on this produced a so-called traffic light survey report. It's called the traffic light survey report because all trusts with a sterile service department had their departments rated as either red, amber, or green. Now, if a department was red, it was seen to have major shortcomings and needed some capital input to require the department to be brought up to requirements. If the department was coded as amber, it was basically acceptable, although not ideal. If the department was categorized as green, then procedures were acceptable throughout. Now, this was a lengthy process, as you can imagine, assessing all sterile service departments within certainly England. And if you have a look at the traffic light survey report, which is still available on the Department of Health website, you will see that all SSDs have two color codings, because those that were not green were given an action plan with a relatively short timescale of improvements to make to raise the standard. And then when those changes had been made and the action plan had actually been put into practice, they were reassessed to determine their new color coding. So the traffic light survey, if the department was green to begin with, it remained green because nothing was required, and those departments that were amber or red had an action plan implemented, and on the second survey they became perhaps amber, meaning acceptable, or probably green, meaning acceptable throughout. And it was the content of the traffic light survey report that was used to demonstrate the decontamination within sterile service departments within England was acceptable throughout. Now, how did that actually change, though, some of those major and fundamental changes, how did they come about? Well, it was due to money, of course. And if you look at slide 12, this indicates how the system was implemented. Remember, there was £200 million allocated by the department for the phase one. To avoid the temptation that trust might have had being given a proportion of that money to spend it on other things, trusts were not given the money. In fact, the money was spent by the department on the trust's behalf, based on requirements of the trust's business case and the response from the traffic light survey reports. So the trusts were able to put their own business case, identify what they needed funding for, and the Department of Health spent essentially the money on their behalf to provide them with what they needed. Now, again, this was a major change in the procurement of decontamination equipment. Nothing like this had ever happened before. The Department of Health was able to use a standard specification, C14, for the purchase of sterilizers, which had been in existence for some time, but had to produce a new standard specification, C30, for the procurement of thermal washer disinfectors. Remember, these are the most important parts of equipment these days, so that we could procure new washer disinfectors of the required standard with the right validation procedures. And the Purchasing and Supplies Agency, PASA, were used for the purchasing process. So this was a complete new protocol for funding, defining, and purchasing decontamination equipment in bulk for the NHS. This had never happened before. Additional instrumentation was also made available for instrumentation to cope for what may be longer turnaround times and any building work required for compliance with the then Health Building Note 13, the planning document and design guide document for sterile service departments, which incidentally was rewritten during this phase one be updated and rewritten to reflect the phase one requirements. Right, moving on to slide 13, we need to look at the progress of phase one. Now, there were promises at a very early stage that the phase one auditing system and financing system for new equipment would be extended to primary care. However, there was a difficulty after about 50% of the money had been spent. Phase one came to an abrupt and sudden stop before there was any application of the process to primary care. One of the major effects that it had on acute trusts, for example, was, as I suggested earlier on, to reduce the number of sites of local decontamination from some very large numbers in some trusts down to hopefully zero. Now, that reduction in the sites of local decontamination in acute NHS trusts is ongoing. Many trusts have reduced it down to a bare minimum, a few have gone down to total zero, and some trusts still have some sites of local decontamination left. We will come back to the implications for local decontamination shortly. But at that time, there was no advice or information given to PCTs, primary care trusts. So then we had this hiatus for a few months, while what was happening was the documentation for phase two of the program was introduced. And you'll see on slide 14 that phase two was effectively a new start, a different process, different aims and objectives, different procedures and management systems. It introduced the National Decontamination Team, a team of advisors to advise people on the implementation of phase two. They produced a 199-page strategy document to define what the national decontamination was all about. And I've taken some extracts from one particular section of that document called The Way Ahead, and you will see that it includes in that little list five indications of where the national decontamination program was heading. Firstly, it was a need to adopt the highest European standards. This had not been universal previously. The decontamination team felt it was a necessity for all decontamination to meet the highest level of European standards. And that would be followed by an inspection regime to make sure that standards were maintained at the particular required level and didn't fall back into previous non-compliances. The solution the trust would use would be a mixed economy, and we'll have a look a second at what the mixed economy might contain. But the major aim was to have a level playing field between decontamination of reusable medical devices in the NHS and in commercial providers. The strange element of this was it also introduced a new style partnership between the NHS and commercial providers of sterile supplies. Again, we'll talk about that in detail shortly. Slide 15, therefore, defines a little bit about what this mixed economy of sterile services provision in the NHS might contain. There would be some intermediate investment at both a central or a local level, and we would also be using or utilizing the existing PFI sterile service departments already up and running within the NHS. By this time, there were a few of those. We would also be using some existing outsourced services. Some trusts had already gone to outsourcing and contracts were still running. And finally, there would be new contractual joint ventures where trusts would combine to seek a partner in the private sector or elsewhere. In other words, outsourcing to large commercial providers of sterile goods, which phrased the famous term super centers to reflect large, privately run sterile service units serving a number of trusts. On slide 16, you will see a little bit of a summary about the differences between phase one and two of this national decontamination program. Now, these three changes don't apply to all cases, but they're taken as a general perception of the differences in the process here. We went from internal renovation to external provision in the main. We went from internal funding to a system that provides mutual financial benefit to NHS trusts and external commercial providers. And trusts in individual cases or combinations or collaborations would procure these services with the help and advice and perhaps some control from the decontamination team. The degree to which this would occur is outlined in slide 17, where the strategy document, remember the 199-page document preceding all this, looked at 11 different options, ranging from doing nothing, which is clearly a not acceptable option, to a couple of options where trusts were clustered together into collaborations to get joint solutions which they could financially afford. And two financial projections were put forward for the cluster option, one with 50 units in England and one with 100 units within England. So we're talking about here straightforward geographical clustering, providing a very much reduced number of style service units within the country to provide the service situation. Now, where were the PCTs in this? Now, luckily, within the strategy document, as you can see on slide 18, section 7.5, which was entitled Future Work, suggested there was a need to consider the requirements of PCTs. It's only a small reference, but you can see the extract I've taken here, consideration needs to be given on how both PCTs and other private sector customers are engaged in this program, demonstrating an awareness that the requirements for PCTs was an important aspect of the National Decontamination Program. Before I come on to what the advice for PCTs is, let me just summarize, I think, on slide 19, what the situation is with the implementation so far. The proposals were that a Pathfinder project, an initial project, put forward initially to give feedback and guidance to later waves of this process, a Pathfinder project for Leeds and Bradford Combined Trusts would happen, and then subsequent waves of cluster projects would go on with lessons being learned, if necessary and where necessary, etc. Now, unfortunately, it didn't work out in that way because there was some delay to the Pathfinder project. Whilst it was a little bit late getting off the ground, it then did delay for some time whilst the parameters of the Pathfinder project changed because of the introduction of two further trusts. So re-tendering had to take place and re-costing and everything else, which is a very lengthy, very expensive process. And the Pathfinder only just remained a Pathfinder because it was ordered very shortly before the second wave came online and further waves are being negotiated. So there were very little lessons, if any, that were able to be learned from the Pathfinder project for the later waves of cluster projects coming on board. And the discussions on the content of the Pathfinder and subsequent projects, there was much discussion on the involvement of PCTs trying to determine if they were included within the supercentres, what their workload would entail. The workload might not be of large numbers, but of course the logistics and collection and distribution of instrumentation to PCTs was going to be a major cost implication to the running of a supercentre. Moving on to be a little bit more specific about the PCTs themselves on slide 20, what advice was given to PCTs? Well, in fact, initially, very little, if any, advice was given to PCTs at all. I've said initially none here, and I think that's probably a fair statement. But whilst Phase 2 was getting off the ground and we were beginning to understand and appreciate the implications of Phase 2, some verbal statements were made to PCTs with respect to their need to comply with the Medical Devices Directive and how they fitted in with the requirements of the Phase 2 of the program. Now, to be honest with you, some of these verbal statements were either conflicting or some knee-jerk reactions to questions, both in public and private meetings, and it was not until 2004 that we actually received some written advice about setting up decontamination services within PCTs. So you'll see the title of the document in italics on the bottom of slide 20. That document, which I call the principles document, main principles to be considered, etc., was initially published in September 2004, was republished in 2005. And this is where all the advice for PCTs and decontamination is contained. Now, I'm a little concerned that I still find PCTs who have not seen this document. So the dissemination of this document within England, certainly, I don't think has been as good as it could have been, and many people are still not aware of what the requirements are stated to be. And, of course, it's very difficult to comply with statements if you're not aware of what they are. So if anybody's not seen this document called Main Principles to be Considered, then this document is available on the Department of Health website. And if you do a search on documentation for principles, decontamination, you will find this document there. I have given you in slide 21 some of the major principles of this document. Paragraph 2, for example, on the main principles document says, where do you want to be? It's a very simple question. The answer, the document tells you, is that you need to have full compliance with the national strategy by the 31st of March 2007. Now, when this document came out in 2004, the 1st of April 2007 seemed a long way away. It's probably about 6 months away, by which time the National Decontamination Program will assume that PCTs will comply totally with the national strategy. Remember, the national strategy was written for sterile services, which requires compliance to the Medical Devices Directive. So by implication, the principles to PCTs document requires compliance to the Medical Device Directive by the 1st of April next year. Now, they've given PCTs some options about how they can meet that, and I will talk about the details of meeting it on the next couple of slides. But on slide 21, item 4, they are giving you the options that are available, and they basically amount to four options. The first one for a PCT is to centralize its decontamination to an accredited sterile services department. This could be outsourcing to an NHS department or outsourcing to a commercially available department. As long as it's accredited to Medical Devices Directive and can CE mark their products, then this is an available option. This requires specification by the PCT, monitoring and control by the PCT, because it still retains the responsibility of its instruments for use on its patients. It's merely contracting the execution of the decontamination. The second option is to universally use single-use devices, very expensive, as we'd already said, and leads to disposal problems, which need to be considered seriously these days. Or, option three, undertake decontamination locally to all applicable standards. This is doing it in-house whilst complying with the Devices Directive, and we'll see the implications of that option on the next two slides. You have, of course, the ability to combine those three options to varying degrees to meet what you would want to do in a PCT. So let's look at what the full compliance, if decontamination is retained locally within a PCT, and these are on two slides, 22 and 23. Now, I've extracted clause 5.3 from the main principles document, which is basically a summary of what you would need to do in a PCT to make decontamination compliant. Clause 5.3 says the key features of Health Building Note 13, a document designed for central sterile service departments, should be followed. For example, you would need a washroom segregated from the clean area with a pass-through. Now, that implies to me, although it doesn't use these words, that you have a washroom and a clean room, and the barrier is, as it is in a sterile services department, a double-ended washer disinfector. So you load instruments on the dirty side, and you unload them in a clean condition on the clean side. That washer disinfector should clearly be an automated process capable of validating itself to meet the requirements for protein removal, amongst other things, being fully validated to HTM 2030, which is a testing document for washer disinfectors, and is routinely and periodically tested to, again, the requirements of HTM 2030. There would need to be a dedicated wash hand basin in the washroom, and there would need to be a clean area with controlled environment on the unloading side of the washer disinfector for sterilizing and, if required, packaging instruments. Now, the use of the term controlled environments suggests environmental control by engineering, which could be air conditioning, which would need to be controlled to specific values and monitored. You may be picking up that this is an expensive and involved process, and it clearly is. In the packing room, you would need a benchtop sterilizer fully validated to HTM 2010 and periodically tested in compliance with HTM 2010, and all staff trained with individual training records available for inspection at any time. Continuing on slide 23, there needs to be a tracking and traceability system relevant to the site of use and the procedures of use for the instrumentation. For example, if those instruments are being used invasively, then they would need to be ideally traceable from patient notes, the precise process data from the automated washer disinfector and sterilizer cycles, so that if the patient or the patient's representative were to ask a question, evidence could be brought up at any later date to demonstrate that the reprocessing of the medical devices used in that procedure were done correctly. Again, we could waste an hour talking about the difference between invasive and non-invasive instruments, but I take a worst-case approach to this. If the sterilizer or washer disinfector is at any time going to be used for reprocessing an invasive device, that's the worst case in which the system should be based. In addition to that, the ongoing costs of maintaining this fully compliant decontamination service should be, first of all, understood, secondly, reviewed, and thirdly, continually made available. If any further sterilizers or washer disinfectors should be purchased, then the framework agreements put forward by PASA that we've seen earlier are available for the purchase of benchtop equipment, although we may have to revise this after recent changes to supplies provision. And essentially, it summed itself up by the last item on slide 23 by saying to fully comply, you will need a mini sterile services department, or decontamination must be done away from the patient treatment areas. Very expensive, very involved process. I think if you were writing a methodology to push you down the line of other options, rather than doing it locally to all compliances, this may be the framework you would produce. On slide 24, does this advice to PCTs apply to all decontamination sites? Well, it certainly applies to treatment areas. It certainly applies to general medical practices. It certainly applies to podiatry clinics. And in theory, also applies to general dental practices, although we have a slight conflict in the dental practice situation because of the existence of a document called A12 entitled Infection Control in Dentistry. Now, the A12 document is jointly published by the British Dental Association and the Department of Health, and you will find a copy of A12 on the websites for both the British Dental Association and the Department of Health. Now, if I can point out some differences in concept between the A12, which dentists see as their own professional body guidelines, and the main principles for PCTs produced by the decontamination program, the one document looks at scenarios which are desirable, and the other document looks at the same scenarios which are essential. So there is a slight conflict in the implementation of either of those documents because they will produce a different end result. And I will come back to that situation just before I finish. Moving on to slide 25, looking at the progress to date of the implementation of the decontamination program as a whole. In the acute sector, we have clearly collaborative groups formed who are undergoing the process of trying to find a mutually convenient and acceptable process with an external supplier to produce sterile supplies. Pathfinder and early projects have been ordered, although they were late, as I've said, and further projects are being negotiated as we speak, and there has been some delay in the implementation of that. The interim situation, of course, is that some recipients of the Phase 1 funding will eventually close, meaning that a lot of investment in equipment and buildings will no longer be relevant. And some departments which were not given any Phase 1 funding at all will continue to function for longer than expected, i.e. beyond the deadline of 1st of April 2007, in what one might call a non-compliant condition. This is leading to some frustration, is the only word I can think of to describe this, within collaborative groups, that the result is taking slightly longer than is expected, and one is unsure of how inspection regimes will approach these difficult situations outlined here after the 1st of April. On slide 26, I've tried to indicate the progress of the National Decontamination Program within PCTs, and if I'm honest with you, progress to date has been very little, maybe because the documentation has not reached people who need to see this. Each PCT is considering their own options, and the combination of PCTs is making this needing to happen at a time when other things are going on. And I also see that there may be an unequal applicability by virtue of the A12 and the principles document for dental and non-dental decontamination. So not only might the wheel being reinvented in different shapes within an individual PCT, it's going to be reinvented in a number of different shapes when we compare one PCT with another. So the interim situation, I think, for PCTs, that there's no change, much non-compliance, and we may end up with a two-tier system. Just to quickly update you with respect to Scotland in slide 27. Now, Scotland's always had a tradition of centralisation of sterile supply because of their geographical difficulties and the logistics of distribution. They were very much closer to centralisation than we've ever been in England. Instead of the Phase 2 report, they produced their own report on decontamination called the Glenny Report, following their own snapshot survey, and they have been the first part of the UK to implement super centres, and the one in Glasgow, which is an in-service NHS, very large sterile services department, has been up and running for some time. Scotland has had a much stronger and cohesive approach, which I think has always covered primary care and endoscopy from the outset. On slide 28, the situation in Wales is slightly different. They have fewer SSDs and sites of decontamination in Wales. They have basically retained their existing in-service structure, and their project was to make all sterile service departments fully compliant and accredited and inspected to the Medical Devices Directive. And Wales is very proud to proclaim that they have now achieved that aim. And so the performance of sterile service departments in Wales is now fully compliant. Northern Ireland has sort of chosen its way very carefully. It's had a similar route to Scotland, has produced a new super centre within the NHS in Belfast, and is retaining its in-service departments as before. To summarise the situation then, hopefully what I've done is go through the way the National Decontamination Programme arose, the reasons for the perceived problems in decontamination, the need to resolve those problems in producing validated systems which were, first of all, capable of demonstrating that they were capable of removing protein, hence protecting us from the variant CJD contamination, and also meeting the highest levels of European standards in terms of accreditation and everything else. However, there are, to my mind, some problem areas that remain. First of all, I think there's a problem with the dental situation in both NHS and private sector practice, as detailed before. The adherence to A12, which is quite understandable for professionals within their own body advice document, may well produce a different or a two-tier standard within a PCT or between public and private sector decontamination, and it is not known what problems that will lead to. In England, I have a problem with endoscopy, because endoscopy has been somewhat absent from the documentation to date, although by implication one might argue that the Phase 2 requirements and the main principles for PCTs applies to decontamination of any sort in any place, therefore including the reprocessing of flexible endoscopes. So one might argue by implication that endoscopy is being included. But we have a dearth of guidance documentation on the design of endoscopy departments. Scotland produced a draft document, a couple of years ago, which has been used as a pattern for what we may be producing in England, and a new health building note to replace the somewhat outdated HBN 52 is being produced in two parts. So HBN 26 on surgical services, part one for theatres, discusses a decontamination room for endoscopes having clean areas and dirty areas. Although part two of that health building note, HBN 26 part two on day surgery, which would include endoscopy, talks about decontamination areas having two rooms, a clean room and a dirty room. So you can see that the later documentation is following the requirements of the main principles document in requiring segregation of clean and dirty, ideally served by pass-through automated washer disinfectors to feed into an environment with a controlled environment for sterilizing, packaging, or storing of flexible endoscopes. So there is a convention that we're looking at segregation, logical flow patterns, controlled environments, controlled personnel access to ensure that we can control, first of all, the decontamination process, remove the possibilities of cross-contamination from protein, whatever sort it might be, and that we have documentation and traceability so that we can determine and redefine at any later date we could be talking up to 20 years plus in the future, that a decontamination process on a single or set of surgical instruments went through the right parameters validated to produce a safe medical device. My final difficulty is that the auditing process, the method of checking that we're all meeting these new requirements, may well be different in two ways. First of all, those sterile service departments who seek accreditation to the Medical Devices Directive and are therefore inspected and accredited by a notified body will follow one route for auditing. Those departments that do not seek that accreditation, or those areas of local decontamination outside a sterile services department, will probably be inspected by the Healthcare Commission. Now, the Healthcare Commission have produced auditing tools for sterile services departments and for endoscopy on their website. So I urge you, if you have an interest here, to have a look at those auditing tools on the Healthcare Commission website. And you will see, if you're involved in either of those two systems, that the Healthcare Commission procedure for auditing on their auditing tool and an SSD audited by a notified body for Medical Device Directive accreditation is a different set of circumstances. So there may well be some differences in the auditing process and a difference in determination of acceptability. However, I think there is one point that is very important to remember in this whole business, and that is the deadline date of the 1st of April 2007. It is now very close. Even when it was projected at the beginning of the process, which has been slowed down by various delays, particularly in the Pathfinder project and whatever, there has been no change to this deadline date of the 1st of April 2007. So whilst I would not expect hordes of inspectors to land on any NHS site on the 1st of April, I think you need to seriously bear in mind that it is a possibility that you may have to justify any non-compliances you have from that date onwards. I think an awareness of any shortcomings is vital, and an action plan to meet or solve those shortcomings is a way perhaps of identifying to any inspecting body, authority or person that the situation is well understood and will be resolved. I think the worst situation is to not be aware of the shortcomings and therefore to have no action plan to cure them. I think the Healthcare Commission would probably take a slightly dim view of that. Somewhat unproven, and I'm talking, really, I'm trying to project what might happen in the future. But take the 1st of April seriously. If you don't have any of the documents that I've referred to, most of them are available on the Department of Health website, www.doh.gov.uk. Do a document search for the main principles, the National Decontamination Program Strategy, A12 document. You'll probably find them all there. Have a look at them and see what the implications are. So in this very brief summary of the National Decontamination Program, I've gone over a period of 6 years. The changes have been tremendous, but the changes are still ongoing. We still have a long way to go in some of these areas. So this is unfinished business, and we still need to keep a handle on this. So I hope you've learned something with the process. If you have any questions, I don't know if we have any time, but certainly I'd be more than happy to answer them on an email basis via Debbie. So thank you very much for listening. At this point, I will hand back to Debbie.
Thank you very much, Peter. I'm sure everyone that has joined us today will agree that was an extremely informative talk about not just what's gone on to lead us to the point we're at today, but also some of the pitfalls and troubles that we're all heading for to comply by the end of March next year. And it does scare me, Peter, when you keep saying it's only 6 months away.
I know.
Unfortunately, we don't have time for any questions at the moment, but as Peter said, I would be delighted to receive those questions on your behalf and pass them on to you, and then obviously respond personally for any queries that you may have. I'd like to take the opportunity again to thank Peter this afternoon for his talk, and once again thank Deb UK Limited for sponsoring today's teleclass. And with that, I bid you farewell to the next teleclass. Bye-bye.